We have, first up, we have an item.
We were in one of the special court.
Where's your gavel?
Sandra, we're down here.
All right, first up this afternoon, we have an item on a continuation of the pet licensing discussion. And Mr. Reeves, we have the attachments in the packet. Would you like to step us through this, taking a kind of a departure?
Yes, it's been a process. So, you know, when we initially looked at this, it was more just from my end, kind of a revenue versus expense sort of issue for me. I had a staff person spending a majority of her time dealing with the pet licensing. I had volunteers that were coming in, helping us enter the licenses as well, catching up on backlogs, all those sort of things. And, you know, for the $8 a license, you know, all those things, obviously it wasn't covering that cost. So the question was, is there a better way to do it? We had come across a company that basically takes over the whole operation. So really, you know, nothing really changes from the consumer end. It's just on our end instead of us doing it. It's handled by a third party. Obviously, you have to pay for that, and that's where we had discussed the fee increase. So once that came out, we had some further discussions, and that brought the issue up with the local veterinarians. And they had some concerns about the whole process. And so I sat down, not with all of them actually at once. I think they're all there even. But we met, and the conversations with them really were the fact that they were kind of in the same boat that we were, that they basically got a dollar license, and it was nowhere near coming to cover their costs for administering the upfront portion of the licensing process for us. So they discussed that they were, you know, concerned with this, that one, we're going to raise the fee, they're still going to have to deal with it, but they really weren't covering their expenses as well. And the conversation then started to turn to, well, you know, really, what's the goal of the licensing? Well, it's to be able to identify an animal if it's picked up running at large. It's to be able to identify an animal if there's a bite incident, something like that. Well, anymore, really, you can do that through microchipping, which is a very common practice, or just, you know, like we do now, a simple ID sort of tag on there. Is the license really a necessary part of this, or is this just an extra step that we're requiring people to pay for? It's not really covering our cost to administering it, and I'm not sure what we're getting as far as the ultimate benefit out of it. So further conversations with the vets, it was also just that they didn't necessarily have a comfort level with when people came in for the rabies vaccinations for their pets to tell them, you need a license, and you know, you have to fill this out. Now, they provide the information to the people, but they were not actively enforcing if people said, no, we don't want to do that, they were, you know, pushing the matter. So basically where it leaves us is this. We have an ordinance that requires a license. If we're going to require it, we should enforce it. If that's the case, from my meetings with the vets, we're probably licensing a quarter of the pets in town, really. So if we're going to enforce it, there's really only one answer, and that is to change the ordinance that would require the vets to give us every rabies vaccination certificate that they do. And then the city would follow up with each of those people to verify if they have a license or not. And if they don't have a license, make sure they get one. Then we're enforcing the ordinance that we have on the books. Now, the veterinarians do not want to do that. They do not feel comfortable turning over all the other rabies documents to the city for us to contact their customers, tell them they need a license, those sort of things. They don't feel comfortable doing that. They don't want to do that. They don't support that option. And then the other option is don't require licensing anymore. Require something else. And what I'm proposing is that we require pets to either be microchipped or to have an identification tag on the animal that identifies the owner and their contact information. We've had the conversation with law enforcement. They're not here. With animal control, we've talked about it. They're on board. The animal control has microchip readers on their vehicle, so they can, when they pick up an animal, if it does not have the tag, they can check it for a microchip to see if there's contact information that way. And the other side with that too is we actually have two local companies that do provide pet IDs, and they also provide a service with those pet IDs where there's a number on there that can be called besides the owner information, where there's a 24-hour number that can be picked up, where they can assist with reconnecting owners with their pets, those sort of things. So that would open it up these two local companies to work with our local vets to get their information out to people, and if people choose to use them, they can. And, you know, really, as you look, more and more cities, and I did include the article from the Star Tribune, that are moving away from licensing. It is something where the same intent can be met with different means than having to require going through the city license. So that's why, between those two options, my recommendation is we limit the licensing. Now, with that, of course, we do bring in money. Now, that money that we bring in doesn't cover our costs involved, but the reality is that it doesn't mean that we stop doing, it doesn't mean that I eliminate an employee now because I don't have her do licensing. I now have her do something that I think is much more beneficial. She'll start working on the document management system as we get that installed with our new Laserfiche system that we've invested a lot of money in, but we need actually some staff to deal with. And so we will have to make up that revenue. We had $62,000 budgeted in this year's budget. We split that half and half between animal control in my office. Animal control's budget is $300,000+ a year, so obviously, you know, it's not the revenue side. This is really, you know, one of their smaller revenue sources. Most of the revenue does come from tax levy. So the reality is we will have to make up whatever, you know, revenue that we lose if we eliminate this year, and then, you know, moving forward other years. And you know, I'm not sure what that option is other than tax levy, because we don't have a permit fee associated with something now to generate that revenue. But I don't know. I've looked at, you know, as far as future budgets, if we look at other, you know, fees and things for my department or for animal control and those sort of things. But, you know, to be honest, the difficult part is yes, we lose the revenue, but it's not covering the cost, and it doesn't seem to make sense to, you know, not do something because we'll lose that revenue to keep somebody doing the same thing. So my options have been either we enforce the ordinance completely, require the vets to get us all the rabies vaccination certificates so we can follow up. We'll increase revenue greatly if we do that. We will have a lot more licensed animals in the community. I'm not sure what it gets us to anything more than what we would require by eliminating the licensing requirement completely and just requiring them to have some sort of ID with contact information or microchip. So it's kind of a full circle where we've gone.
A couple of comments. It sounds like, according to your memo, that we would forego about $52,000 in fees. And I was kind of surprised to read that we're only seeing roughly quarter compliance, 0.25% or 25% compliance citywide. And then the other comment was, even if we did force the veterinarians to turn over their records, that assumes that people are compliant with getting the rabies vaccination. There are probably a fair number of pet owners out there that don't comply with that. So we're still not going to catch.
No, you still won't catch them all. And also, then the other argument that goes with that requirement is that it may deter people from getting the rabies vaccination if they know that they also have to get a license and things like that after they do the first vaccine. That was some of the concerns for the vet.
Mr. Bildebeck, then Mr. Hickey.
Question. So I think getting rid of the revenue in this case sounds like a reasonable thing to do. But my question then is, if animal control picks up an animal that is not either microchipped or tagged, what happens?
Same thing that happens right now. I mean, we impound the animal. We do what we can to advertise that we have this animal. You know, they have Facebook pages, they have other things that they use to try to get that information out. And then after that, they try to adopt the animal out if nobody comes to claim it, those sort of things. So it would be no different than now if somebody doesn't have a licensed animal.
If it's claimed, do we require them to either put a tag on it?
What we do now, if it's claimed, is they get a fine for, you know, okay, having an animal at large, unlicensed, all those things. We make them licensed at that time, make sure they get the tag, make sure their vaccinations are up to date, all those sort of things. So that wouldn't change in our ordinance. All it would be that if you pick up an animal that doesn't meet their ordinance, proposed ordinance change, or not microchipped or not with an ID, it would be the same thing. They'd still get the fine. We'd force them to, in this case, we'd probably microchip the animal, you know, like that. So we would basically follow the same process.
Okay, that's good. I just wanted to make sure we had a process in case he didn't have the microchip or tag.
Okay, Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, my question is, you answered most of that for him. It's along those same lines. So is this, what kind of contact would, if someone called in and said, I don't think this dog has a tag, does someone follow up on that? Or is it just if it's an abandoned dog, or what would generate that
We'll sometimes get complaints now, but usually it's not a complaint that animal's not licensed. It's more that this animal's barking, this animal's doing whatever, and then we send animal control out, and then they verify is it licensed or whatever. So in this case, I think it would probably be something similar, where usually we'll get the complaint that this animal's running free in our neighborhood all the time. Right. Can you check? And if that's the case, then same situation. We send animal control. If they pick it up, if it's not chipped or doesn't have an ID, we impound the animal. Try to find the owner. When the owner came in, then we, they'd go through whatever they have to pay, and then they'd also make sure that we get a microchip.
And what's the fine now for an unlicensed dog, roughly?
I'm not sure what the fine is for an unlicensed
dog. Okay.
It's a misdemeanor, I think, is what it is.
Well, we were using the administrative citation form, so it's up to $60.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Mayor.
What's it cost to get a dog or a cat chipped?
Chipping, I think the vet said, is roughly $50. Is that about right?
It varies on where you do it. The other thing I would point out is, and maybe you want this in there, is when we get a chipped animal, someone brings in a stray, well, half the time the info is not up to date. So it's not like it's magic.
Right.
The microchip sends you to a place where you have to keep your info updated. And if you change your, dumped your landline or change your cell phone and not bother to update it, then your microchip is worthless. So they're not magically send you right to the house. That there has to be some, upkeep with them. So it might be that you say correct, up to date information on the table.
But we would definitely
half the time
that.
It's like, so what? They got a microchip. Still don't know who this dog is.
And then that's also why we didn't say you have to microchip, because it is expensive. And not everybody can afford that. So that's why we give the option to also just have an ID. And like I said, the other part too is that we do have local companies that provide IDs. They provide 24-hour numbers. They have a website. They have all these things that who I've talked to and I've said, this would be a great opportunity for you if we require it. You could, set up with the local vets, advertise your service, and, see how it goes.
All right. Other comments, thoughts?
So who does that initially? Or it's not required, but...
the microchipping? Or?
Yeah. When does it happen? When the puppy?
Well, a lot of people will do it at the time of the spay or the neuter, because it is a very large needle. It's like a 18-gauge needle, and it does hurt a little bit to inject the microchip. So a lot of times people opt to do it while they're anesthetized. But you can do it in an awake animal. It pinches...
It hurts.
Vastly bigger needle than when you draw blood or anything like that. But it can be done at any time. Some people do it even at, I think Dr. Bailey does it at shows or things like that, different events.
Well, and what we talked about is right now we have rabies clinics in town every year, and we have staff that goes to also sell licenses at the rabies clinic. Well, what we'd be looking at is that these rabies clinics also promote chipping at the same time during the rabies clinic.
I agree with that. Part of it, but I would keep in mind that all the animals that ever see the light of day come up for those rabies clinics, and sometimes it's hard enough just to get a rabies vaccine versus a very large needle.
Well, and that's what we're not requiring. We'd like to offer it during those
right.
clinics.
Right, but yeah, some of those animals, you're lucky you get out alive.
Yep.
Other comments, Mr. Campion?
I just wanted to say I'm really happy we kind of thought outside the box here and didn't limit ourselves to how better to do what we're already doing. I fully support eliminating this. If we can't do it at a break-even point, and I think we're seeing kind of a decline in the necessity of a license to reunite families and animals, that I think that it's entirely reasonable to eliminate this and move staff to other more meaningful projects going forward. I think there are already existing markets for this exact purpose, and I don't see us adding a whole lot to what's already offered. So I support this for sure.
One thing I think is a new element, and I'm personally aware of at least two situations where social media is a game changer here, that an animal is posted with photos and oftentimes social media spreads the word far better than what we even can with our animal control and so forth. So, historically that wasn't an option, obviously, but, maybe, as you say, thinking outside the box and using other ways of communicating that information. And again, this doesn't take away any of our ordinance as far as dangerous animals and how we treat those. That's still a fairly severe situation. And that's not changing. All we're really talking about is the method of identification, the requirement for the licensing tag. Anyway, my comment. Other thoughts?
I just have a question, please. Do I understand that the that you have a local pet ID company that would do the licensing?
Well,
there is no license.
They would provide identification tags, like a 24-hour number. So we have actually two local companies that do that.
Yeah.
So that's what I said. It would be a great opportunity for them if we made this change, because they could advertise their information all over. They could work with the vets to advertise, and you know, they could probably pick up a lot more clients that way, with the understanding that, you know, you're required to have this ID, and we offer this service for you.
And would they be microchipping as well?
No, they just handle the providing an ID, providing a call center number, and those sort of things.
Okay, so the microchip would always be done in the vet's office.
Yeah.
There is a loss of revenue that needs to be offset. I mean, when we have a $200+ million budget, I really hate whining too much over the, you know, tens of thousands, and it seems like at least get some increased staff productivity out of it. I don't have an issue with that. And my only comment would be, if you can't afford to chip an animal, the national average cost I read was about $45, pretty similar to the $50. You shouldn't have a pet in the first place. I mean, it's a one-time charge, and just feeding an animal, go through that pretty quickly. And, you know, so I think to, you know, cry poverty about not being able to chip an animal is kind of crazy, but I'm fine with getting rid of this.
All right, other comments?
Let me ask the lady from the vet's office or the vet. Are there any breaks for people who can't afford to have the microchip? Would love to have that.
I mean, maybe in different locations. I mean, not necessarily, you know, at our clinic. Maybe there's different functions that do that. You know, it's, veterinarians give away a lot of services the way it is. They can't give away absolutely everything. The other thing I'll say is just sort of a common sense thing is, if there's a tag on the dog that has a phone number, you don't even have to get animal control involved.
Right.
You know, I mean, if people, and I mean, yes, maybe we have to say that they have to do it, but I mean, we get phone calls, because I own the clinic, we get phone calls for the rabies tag on the weekend, and it's just, and that's fine, and we can go in and find the number, but if they just had their phone number on them, they'd already be done, rather than trying to get a hold of somebody, with a scanner, because again, I mean, animal control is great, but they're not always going to be there with their scanner. I mean, sometimes it's really hard to get a hold of them.
Sure.
So, just, you know, promoting common sense. If you have the, what I love are the collars with the phone number right on there in bold. Because even if the dog's scared, you can read the number. You don't even have to touch, you know, the dog, apparently.
Is there concern about obligating, you know, people that go to the vet to provide those sorts of, I mean, you referred to it as common sense, and I think I'm kind of on the same board here, that it's common sense to put your phone number and name on your pet to make sure. I mean, is there a restriction in what we're allowed to obligate veterinarians to provide? I mean,
well, this would be just the kind of the requirement that the pet owner has an ID on their animal. So it's not that the vet has to do it. They could get the ID from the vet. They can get it from one of the other two companies in town. They can go to Petco, and they have an ID machine right there for $5. You can get one made. So, yeah, we wouldn't be obligating the vets to have to do it. There'd be any option the consumer wants to use, the pet owner wants to use.
And to be honest, whenever somebody comes in and I see they have a microchip, I scan it to make sure it's still there. And then at that point, I remind them to keep their info updated. And after they're like, oh, I never thought about that. I thought it just said who I was when you're on the scanner. You know, I mean, people think it just, you know, magically shows up on the scanner. This
just calls my cell phone.
Sandy, and it lives with this address. And all this is a number that goes through a database.
I get it. I completely agree. It seems like common sense. I'm in support.
And I think that's an interesting comment. Truly responsible pet owners will probably go get a tag anyway. I mean, that's what I would do, and whether I'm obligated or required to or not, I would probably do that just because it's the responsible thing to do. And those folks that probably aren't sharing that same level of responsibility, they're not getting a tag anyway.
Yeah.
They're part of that 75%.
That's right.
So, any other comments? I'm sensing that there would be a consensus to accept the recommendation of the city clerk to rescind the requirement for licensing and tags.
So the next step would be the preparation of an ordinance that would accomplish its proposal.
Correct.
I'll work with the city attorneys on that for the next call.
Is that the consensus?
Yes.
Can I ask another question? Since I'm the one that's selling the license, does that mean we're done?
No,
not yet.
Not until the ordinance is approved. It's all said or nothing.
Okay.
Not quite.
But then, you know, I mean, right now, should I just have my staff not telling them to buy a license that things are changing, because it right. it look, makes us look really stupid to be like, yeah. you want to buy your license next week? You don't need your license. Yeah.
I don't,
I'll send out an email.
If that's what you're doing, we just don't want to hear about it.
We can do
that. But I mean, next week we'd have to let them know they don't need that license.
I would bet the news media will make sure that this would spread quickly.
Yeah.
If you're asking for the city to direct you to violate the ordinance that we have in place, you're probably not going to get that answer, but use your common sense.
And then you said the people that have bought licenses this year will get refunds? You
well, that's, we'll have to, I'm not sure, we haven't really discussed if we're refunding the $8 or anything like that. I mean, it seems to me that it's not a huge number, and I don't know.
I'd recommend we don't get involved in refunding.
I would agree.
I would think that would be a pain.
Well, then yeah. I, for one, will be violating ordinance that's in place.
Okay, anything else on that item? The only other item we really have today, unless someone brings up under other business, is just a review of the upcoming schedule, and just a couple of note items. Based on the emails I received, we'll not be meeting next week on the 9th, since several of us will be attending National League of Cities. So what I have for the 3/16 meeting would be a review of the fat, oil, and grease proposed ordinance and the Verizon small cell project. And then beyond that, I have that we'll review the revised city website on March 23rd. Mr. Quenbold or anyone else, were there other
changes? That's it for right now.
Changes, Mr. Campion?
So I'd like to just note that at last meeting, I did ask for an item to be added to the agenda today, but it looks like it slipped through the cracks, and I didn't see the agenda set until it was a little bit too late. So with the maybe unanimous approval of the council, I'd like to bring forth the discussion of parkland facilities and incentive development, if you guys would.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, so having talked with the Parks Department a little bit, and I don't know who wants to represent the Parks Department. Perfect. I'm sure some questions will come up, but I'll kind of lay a little bit of groundwork. With incentive and restricted developments, they're being utilized a lot to redevelop downtown, and they're frankly kind of providing a bridge between what is happening right now with the comp plan, kind of leading toward the future, and what we already have, which is kind of the existing zoning area. And it's giving us some flexibility to operate, providing some leeway where we need it in order to make sure that we're continuing to get the sort of development that the community needs. And what we're seeing is one kind of one consequence of that is the incentive and restricted developments don't require any sort of dedication for parkland. They don't require any sort of additional consideration of available park space or anything like that. So what I was going to suggest is that we consider adopting a different metric for the availability of utilities. And one of them is looking about like existing and future planned utilities, it doesn't include parkland. And we actually have a section in our ordinance under site design modification, section 64130, that has a more robust explanation of what adequate public facilities are and includes parkland as one of the necessary public facilities. So what I was going to propose is that we consider amending the language of the incentive and incentive development under 62600 and restricted development under 62700 to use the adequate public facilities under 64130 to allow us to better evaluate whether or not an area has the necessary park facilities to support a project, mm-hmm. and also allow that developer to work with us to make sure that that we can have those facilities available as these neighborhoods turn over, maybe get a little bit more dense, maybe have more people to serve, making sure that as a system our parks are able to keep up with the increased demand that's coming as part of the influx of new residents into Rochester, and kind of wanted to bring that forward and see if there were any strong opinions here.
And Mr. Campion and I had a chance to talk about it. It made sense to bring this up. I agree that we have to be careful that just because we're considering certain styles or development processes, we don't want to get too far behind in terms of some of the recreation space we provide, which we normally consider if it were a brand new development being proposed. And I think the final thing that Mr. Campion was going to suggest is that if there were agreement, we would actually
defer this to or give this to the park board to do the research.
Yeah, and I completely agree. This is kind of some feedback, you know, as I kind of thought over it and got a little bit of feedback. One of the ideas was take this, and I think this is the appropriate course of action, is take it to the Parks Board, ask for their approval, and make sure that they have the capacity to deal with if this produces additional funds or this produces additional land dedication, that they're ready to deal with that. And I feel confident talking with some of the Parks Department, that sounds like we're relatively confident that they would support that.
Yeah, a couple of things for you, just kind of backing up one
thing
for you. Park dedication is premised upon by neighborhood decisions for the state is a land subdivision to occur. In this case here, what we're talking about is an incentive or restrictive development that is asking for you folks for some modification of the ordinance in exchange for some benefit to the public. This is one topic that may benefit the public is having a parkland. That's why the change that Nick talked about, Nick and that change. As far as going back to the park board, this is actually a council ordinance that you adopted. If you ask the park board to review that, we sure can. But really, the park board will say, if we're going to get more parkland or park fees out of this, we can find a way to utilize those funds and facilities.
I think it's a reasonable action to show that we want to make sure we have investment from both sides. Because part of this, going back, I had to talk with you guys a little bit about how necessary it is to kind of lay that groundwork for what I hope can be a discussion about a master plan or something going forward. But to start that bilateral discussion with them about ownership and who's going to, how we're going to continue to drive this policy-wise, and we're going to drive this in terms of maintenance and requests that are going to come down the pipeline. So I'm happy taking it back to the Parks Board just to make sure that they're familiar with what we're looking at. And I would be happy to be at that meeting too to make sure that if you guys have any comments you'd like to share, that they get shared with them as well.
Mr. Hickey?
And I'm just trying to understand the intent here. So we're looking at the comp plan is what, we're less than a year out on the comp plan?
Yeah.
So this is, you know, just be a stopgap in the interim, or what do we?
It's certainly a stopgap. I think reasonableness of, so it is a year out maybe. I think that's fair. But there's a timeline for us to actually update all the legislation that would need to support the comp plan as well. So I think there's going to be a period of time, I hope it's short, but where we have this completed comp plan, but we don't necessarily have the ordinances all facilitating the new vision for the community or the new embodiment of the vision for the community. So I think you can look at it as a stopgap, but you can also, I think it's appropriate to suggest that the stopgap may last a bit longer than we project. Maybe not just a year, it might be a couple years before we can fix it. And frankly, I don't know if I know where you're going, I think we're seeing incentive development used quite a bit. So I think it's certainly reasonable to make sure that we don't potentially starve a really necessary component of our community to do it. And I mean facilities.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand too, like, you know, I can certainly think of this, you know, dedicating parkland when you're doing a subdivision. But if we're talking like, you know, an apartment complex, are we talking that there's adequate parkland in the vicinity, or they have to dedicate part of this infill development to parkland?
I think that's a really good example. Okay. Is if you take like 2 4 units and then you build a 20 unit, you've increased the capacity, the need for additional capacity on the parks, and yet, you know, our existing evaluation criteria don't allow us to evaluate the projects like that, don't allow this give and take sort of thing on parkland. So I think you can even look at redevelopment inside a neighborhood and say, without really changing, you know, the bounds of the neighborhood or anything about that, you can increase the need for parkland in those facilities. And I look at it system-wide. You know, I take my kids across town to Southeast to go visit some of their parks, or Northeast to visit those parks. And it's really about maintaining the health of the system at large.
So, and like Mr. Ruska said, so in that example, it would probably be cash in lieu of, is what we're saying?
I'm not taking anything off the table. I think what we have to kind of probably consult the city attorney and make sure that, you know, what our limitations would be. But certainly based on the criteria as written today, it's public, it's available or planned public facilities. So it does seem like there's some capacity there for the developer to enhance prior to development as part of the agreement.
I think another thing we talked about is that we're seeing that the developers want to try to provide those sorts of services, so they'll provide things like tot lots,
And we might view those really as more of a Band-Aid, when in fact it's better to support a broader neighborhood, you know, enhance an existing park system or something like that. And, you know, a tot lot is really, as I say, more of a Band-Aid that might not serve the true purpose.
Yeah.
Mr. Ruska.
Just tag on that. It seems like that's kind of an amenity of the facility. So I guess, you know, I like what Nick's bringing up here. I guess I kind of wish... I know we've talked about, you know, trying to save some of the pristine land and some of these developments as maybe a natural type park too. So I think, you know, there's a lot of new thought thinking that we'd like to incorporate here. And Paul and Mike, if you might, you guys are doing a strategic planning right now, and you're taking all this kind of things into consideration currently, aren't you, too? So does this kind of fit in with what you're doing as far as some of your planning for the future?
There's two components of what we're doing right now. One's a strategic plan, which is more the mission vision of where we're going to go as a department. The second is a master plan that we've talked about from our system for a parkland system. But that was a great point. We look at these natural areas as being very important to also. It's just not about green space and turf to go play out. The natural space is also very important to have.
Right. So if you had some type of a, you know, way that, even if you look at, like as Nick talks about here, you know, a cash in lieu of, and maybe there's additional money that goes towards a recreational trail that can connect, you know, an area that's maybe a little denser to an area that's a little bit more of a natural area, and that helps the funds to get that trail done. So, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and I certainly would like to see us look into
it. Mr. Roger?
Well, I'd like some more information from the attorney's office or from... staff, other staff, on exactly what we're allowed to do, because in my eyes, a 60-unit apartment building generates a similar demand for recreation space as 60 single-family detached homes, but we don't get that the way it currently works because we only do this at the time of land subdivision. And, you know, so I'm curious of what tools, techniques, or frankly loopholes there might be to get to secure a fair contribution from these different housing styles, since the multifamily is going to become more and more pervasive in the community. And in addition to that, is there a way that when we do land subdivision, how much discretion do we have in terms of when we subdivide that land? You know, if we're creating land that is R4, do we have the ability to secure sufficient higher incremental amount of parkland dedication to cover the higher population density there than we would in R1? And I don't know the answer. I'd like to see answers to those questions.
If you want a real brief answer,
yeah.
The ordinance is based upon 8 acres per 1,000 dedication. So regardless of your 30 units per acre or 3 units per acre, the dedication required is the same.
But he's asking about the statutory, the state law that allows parkland dedication in the first place.
It's based on subdivision of land.
Okay.
Is that criteria?
And so that's what I'm desperately trying to find, and I'm having absolutely no success in doing so.
And we got time.
I didn't know this was going to be on the agenda. But there is a statute. Everything we do on parkland dedication flows from the state law. We can't deviate from the state law. So I need to find that out before we get much further
sure.
down the road.
So I'll wait to hear from the attorney until I take it to the park board. But if we can find a way to do it, I would... I'll wait for the...
Well, I think it's good to start the conversation and look at these ideas and see what we can do.
And I think, as is our practice, we just wanted to... Mr. Campion wanted to bring this up to the council to see if there was a majority of consensus before we would ask staff to go off and spend time researching the item.
Maybe one other thing I'd be interested in, too, is I understand the Three Rivers Park District has kind of looked at a model in the state of Minnesota for how they do parks, and I'm curious what they're doing for parkland dedication.
Do you want it back to you, then, before it goes to, again, one more time before it goes to park? Or?
It sounds like that was the preference.
Good thing to do.
Yep. Okay.
So is there a consensus that we should investigate this further, at least discover some more?
All right. Fantastic. That's all I had on it.
All right. Was there any other business for this afternoon?
On your committee, the whole calendar, just remember that the Ethical Practices Board would like a meeting date to present their annual report.
What date would they like?
They're looking to you for that.
I'm actually, we're open. It's whenever they would like to come, whenever they were ready.
So anytime in March on a Monday is available?
I think we've got the 16th full, but we could do the 23rd.
Okay, I will check with Audrey.
Okay. All right, anything else this afternoon? All right, then we are adjourned until this evening. Thank you.
4 o'clock. This is uncommon.
Maybe it's a trend.
I was going to say, it's still sunny out. It's a beautiful, beautiful day.
I'll find it.
I got my money on what you can be.
Appreciate all the insights. Good to get that feedback from people who actually have to do what we're talking about. Thanks for coming.
The point is, it's not the only
okay.
Stay in tune.